I was talking to you about the Nazi rise to power. The Great Depression, which economic depression in the world, which began in 1929, in America it continued pretty much until the beginning of the Second World War. It had a very destabilizing effect on Europe generally and on Germany particularly. Enormous unemployment. People already were ravaged by inflation in the 1920s, which wiped out their savings and wiped out the pensions, made them worthless. And now you had tremendous deflation, so that the assets that a person owned were worth very little. And the continuing instability caused by the communists in Germany, the everyday street battles between the Nazis and the communists, all of which combined to destabilize the entire country. And the the Nazis were the ones that promised that they would stabilize the country. And they did. But the way they did it would eventually prove the destruction of tens of millions of people. In the elections of 1929, the Nazi Party was very successful. In the elections of 1931, they were also successful. In the final election before Hitler's ascent to power, they were less successful. But by then, they had perfected the means that no parliamentary government could run because of the rioting and the fighting that they did in the parliament, beating up their opponents. And they were seemingly, there was no way to control it. The president of the republic, Paul von Hindenburg, who was a German war hero from World War I, appointed a man by the name of Franz von Papen as chancellor, meaning prime minister of the country. And von Papen tried to bring some semblance of order in government, but he was thwarted in everything that he did. First of all, he himself was a nefarious character, and couldn't manage it because the continued instability caused by the Nazis. So finally, Hindenburg, von Papen, the German industrialists, the people of other parties, all made the same mistake. The mistake was that they thought that they could control Hitler. If you made Hitler the head of the government, well, then he would feel the responsibilities. All of his rhetoric wouldn't count for much. And they thought that he would do a miserable job. And that would end him and, to a certain extent, end his party as well. He would be disproved by the events that occurred and that it would all go well for them. So they made this momentous mistake of underestimating Hitler. Mistake that would be repeated by many others. And Hitler was appointed chancellor. Now, there was an emergency law that had been passed in the 1920s yet that gave the chancellor the right to suspend certain civil rights in cases of emergency. Hitler did that immediately. Suspended all civil rights, and began his ruthless campaign to destroy anyone that was against him. He was abetted by a fire that occurred soon after he came to office, called the Reichstag fire. The parliament building burned down. Till today, there are different opinions as to who did the job. But Hitler blamed the Jews and the Bolsheviks. And Hitler was able always to tie the Jews to the Bolsheviks. He always emphasized that Bolshevism was a Jewish plot. And the fact that many of the Bolsheviks, the leading Bolsheviks, were Jewish, only served as support for this idea. And because of this Reichstag fire, many say, by the way, others say that the German Nazis themselves set the fire as a provocation. But because of this fire, he was able to put these draconian emergency decrees into effect, and they started rounding up people, thousands of people. And they set up concentration camps in Germany. And even though the concentration camps were not originally killing camps, the circumstances of life there were of such a nature that many, many people died, quote, of natural causes, unquote. But this became an accepted practice, that you could arrest people and send them away. And there was no defense against it. Now, in Hitler had a paramilitary organization called the SA, the Brown Shirts. He also had a smaller but more lethal paramilitary organization called the SS, who were the Black Shirts. And Hitler wanted to get rid of the SA and of its leadership because he felt that they could pose a threat to him. Yes? Well, they were originally, the SS was supposed to be Hitler's personal bodyguard. It later developed into the most elite German fighting units, and it developed into the trained killers, the executioners of the death camps, etc. The SA was like parallel to the army. Eventually, most of the people who belonged to the SA ended up in the German army. But here it had an independent existence, and Hitler was determined to end that. So in 1934, there was a purge of the SA called the Night of the Long Knives, in which hundreds of leaders of the SA were killed, as well as people who were not members of the SA, who just happened to have similar names. And thousands were arrested and sent to the concentration camps. So it was a purge within Hitler's own ranks. Hitler had learned that from Lenin and Stalin. The archetype of all of this totalitarianism is the Soviet Union. And to a great extent, it is the it's responsible for much of the anti-Semitism in the world even today. One does not realize how dangerous the Soviet Union was, and how evil it was. And the worst thing is that how many people believe that it was the salvation of humanity, when it turned out to be the greatest destruction imaginable. So in 1934, he purges the Nazi Party. And by 1936, Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, is very close to Hitler, and the SS becomes the major force. There also was a police force called the Gestapo, that pretty much enforced all of the decrees. People did not, if the one was arrested by the Gestapo, one did not leave either alive, or if alive, one did not leave unharmed. Now, in 1936, Berlin hosted the Olympics. And the Olympics has a long and sorry history of anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism. And in 1936, Jews were kept off the American team, the United States of America team, because they didn't want to insult Hitler. But there was a black...
Why did they care?
What did who care?
Americans.
Oh, the Americans. You know, it was a very strong Nazi party in America. German-American Bund. The very strong anti-Semitic parties that ran for office. America that was not the America that we think of today. America was not very hospitable in the 1930s to Jewish interests. And it'll be reflected in the attitude of the government towards Jewish immigration, towards the Holocaust. All of that was reflective of the nativism and anti-Semitism that was very prevalent in America then. I think I mentioned to you that there was a Catholic priest by the name of Father Coughlin from Detroit who broadcast every Sunday for a half hour on American radio on called the Blue Network, on the Mutual Network. It was just a half hour rant against Jews. So people, the Jews were exposed to all sorts of open prejudice. There were quotas on Jewish students in all universities. There were quotas on Jewish doctors in all hospitals. Jews were... It was certainly better than living in Europe, but it was not, one should not think that it was a paradise. And so in 1936, when the Olympics took place in Berlin, so Hitler naturally wanted that the Germans should win every medal because they were the master race, they were the Aryan race. And there was an Austrian swim team composed of Jews, a women's swim team, that again was discriminated against and couldn't participate. And Hitler got his comeuppance because the American, Afro-American Jesse Owens won a number of gold medals in track and field. But Hitler refused to present the medals to him because of the fact that he was of color. Since in America, people of color were discriminated against openly, so no one felt that bad about it. No one, was overly concerned. All of this, is, I'm telling you, is the backdrop to how things happened.
Excuse me.
Hitler went after, I mentioned last time, regarding eugenics and euthanasia. Hitler killed tens of thousands, over 75,000 in the first year, of people who were in mental asylums or who were deformed or were handicapped or didn't meet his... of racial standards. Now the Germans had also, yeah, and this is all a pseudoscience, they all had scientists and doctors that backed this up. So they would measure people, they'd measure their nose, they'd measure their cranium, in order to determine what, you know, what race you really came from. And if you didn't meet up with the standards, so then it was either a concentration camp or the first experiments with gassing people in mass numbers took place in the asylums under medical supervision. And all of this was going to be for the benefit of the Third Reich. Now, Hitler had grand plans. And his grand plans included the complete domination of Europe, the dismantling of the British Empire, the destruction of the Jews, and again, no one took him seriously. Everyone underestimated his evil, and they underestimated his intent and what he really meant when he said. He makes demands on Austria. Now, Austria was originally, for many, many centuries, was a great empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it controlled the Balkans, it controlled many places, and it controlled parts of Germany. Beginning in the 1800s, it started to get whittled down. Bismarck defeated Austria and took back the German territories. In the First World War, Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, all were broken away from the Austrian Empire. They were left with Austria. Austria was overwhelmingly German, overwhelmingly Roman Catholic, overwhelmingly anti-Semitic. Between the wars, many Eastern European Jews from Poland came to settle in Austria, especially in Vienna. Over 30,000 came. They were highly resented by the Austrians. They were a foreign element. They were not the assimilated Jew of Western Europe, but they were the Eastern European Jew. And even the secular Eastern European Jew was not the assimilated Jew of Western Europe. And certainly not the Hasidic Jew, most of whom who came to Austria were Hasidic because they came from Galicia, which was the heartland of Hasidus. Hitler demanded that Austria, he said Austria is an artificial country. It's really Germany. People there are Germans, they speak German, they want to be German. And he demanded that Austria be annexed by Germany. Then, in effect, that Austria should go out of business and become part of Germany. The Austrian Nazi Party was even worse than the German Nazi Party, if we can imagine such a thing. And most of the killers and fanatical Nazis were Austrians, Eichmann, Heydrich. Hitler himself was an Austrian. So Hitler, Austria was defenseless. Hitler had rearmed Germany. The Allies had let him do that with great help from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union helped produce tanks and train the tank crews. I mean, Stalin's great error is that he thought that he was going to outsmart Hitler. Hitler, to a certain extent, outsmarted him. And Hitler demanded that Austria be reunited with Germany. He said that there would be a plebiscite. The people of Austria could vote. But a few days before the vote, the German army invaded Austria and took it naturally without a shot, occupied Vienna. Then there was a vote, and the vote was 97.5 in favor of the Anschluss, of the uniting of Austria with Germany. Hitler was impatient. He probably would have won the plebiscite without the army, but that never stopped him. And a reign of terror descended upon the Jews in Austria. Jews were forced to scrub the streets of Austria, of Vienna, in front of jeering mobs, many times with water mixed with acid. Jewish women were abused and assaulted. It was terrible. And again, except for some vapid diplomatic protests, nothing happened. The Jews from Austria looked to leave. So many of them left for Germany because they thought it would be better in Germany. But the truth was there was really no place to go. A lot of them went to Czechoslovakia. Wherever they went, they would meet Hitler, you know, in the next year. Went to Belgium. And those that were able to escape to England or to the United States, and they were relatively very few in number, or to come here to the land of Israel, so they escaped. But most did not escape. And there was a concentration camp set up at Theresienstadt. It's called Terezin today. Not far from Prague in Czechoslovakia, where most of them ended up. And that was a transit station on the way to Auschwitz. Now, Hitler, he has Austria now. Hitler wanted to swallow Czechoslovakia, too. Czechoslovakia was also an artificial country, and Czechoslovakia had three separate ethnic groups that were lumped into one country, and all three groups despised each other, which is always a good idea to unite them. And you had the Bohemians, the Czechs, who were in the western part of the country. You had the Slovaks, in the Slovakians in the eastern part of the country. And in the northern part of the country, you had what was called the Sudetenland, meaning the southern lands of Germany. You had 5 million Germans. Hitler used the 5 million Germans as his lever against Czechoslovakia. He said that the Sudeten Germans are being persecuted. Every day in the German papers there were stories of atrocities that were performed against the Sudeten Germans. Most of the stuff that he said was made up. Almost all of it was certainly exaggerated, but that made no difference because the Nazis were masters at propaganda. They were not interested in... They had absolutely no moral compunctions. It's such an amoral society, it's hard for us to imagine it. For instance, in the Soviet Union, which was also amoral, but they always covered it up with high-sounding phrases. Whereas the Nazis never bothered to do that. They said that what they're doing is the best thing for Germany. And that's their response. If it means killing out people, you can kill out people. The Nazis destroyed the gypsies. Just like that. Nazis destroyed all the homosexuals. But by choosing their victims, they were, like for instance, destroying the homosexuals. So the church didn't say anything, because the church is also against the homosexuals. And destroying the gypsies, so the upper classes didn't say anything, because they felt the gypsies were a terrible bother in their behavior, in the way they, all the stories with the gypsies. So when it came to the Jews, they didn't say anything about the Jews either, because they also felt that the Jews were too pushy. Too much a part of society, too disproportionately represented, etc. So in choosing the victims, he always had allies. Yes.
There was a certain amount of protest against the euthanasia that you described earlier, and in fact, much of it stopped because of that. Am I correct?
Well, it stopped. It stopped for three reasons. Stopped. First of all, they ran out of victims. Number one, he had done almost all of it. Secondly, especially with the Olympics, he wanted to present a better face to the world. And the third reason was that really there were protests, right? And so he figured he'll get them a different way. He doesn't have to get them this way. But the euthanasia program continued until 1944, when Germany had already lost the war. They still were killing people in Germany that they felt were not racially pure or not physically strong.
They were called useless eaters. I didn't realize
right.
It
had
gone on.
It went on till the end. The difference between the Nazi Empire and the Soviet Empire and other empires, let's say the Greek Empire, the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, the British Empire, is that every empire in the world left over something positive. Even though they were murderers, killers, colonizers, etc., but they left over something positive. Art, literature, architecture, governmental systems, laws, highways, something. These two left over nothing.
What about IBM?
Well,
it's the result of the Nazis, isn't it?
No. Who said IBM's a result of an IBM is a result of Watson and an American company.
Yeah, but it was developed more under the Nazis.
Well, they collaborated with the Nazis.
Yeah, it left no positive thing. All the technology, everything would have been developed without them. They are not the source of it. The emptiness of this 12, 15 year period, or the emptiness of the 75 years of communism, is just astounding. Now, Hitler therefore made demands on Czechoslovakia that it give it cede the Sudetenland back to Germany. Now, Czechoslovakia was not Austria. Czechoslovakia was no pushover. Czechoslovakia had a big army, had a very strong armament industry, the Skoda Arms Works. You know, they have Skoda automobiles today. Czechoslovakia had a strong defense line built, fortifications all along the German border. It would have been a major war. It could be that Germany would have won, but not without great cost. Now, the borders of Czechoslovakia were guaranteed by England and France. Under the Treaty of Versailles, they guaranteed that the borders would not be touched, and that if anybody made aggression against Czechoslovakia, England and France would fight on the side of the Czechs. Now, governments usually give such guarantees in the full hope that they will never have to pay them. That's why they grant them. We should remember that here, too. It's okay. It's here. We should remember this when we deal also with guarantees. That government guarantees are rarely can be cashed in full. Because people are fickle, right? Everybody wants to go to war in Iraq. Today the American people, we just say, take the soldiers home, we don't want to go to war. So we like to have a war where nobody dies. That's basically the kind of war that we like. Nobody gets killed. It's over in 3 weeks and we can all be back in time for the Super Bowl and there's no problem. So Hitler makes his demands on Czechoslovakia. The Premier of France, Daladier, and the Prime Minister of England, Neville Chamberlain, develop a policy. Today the word is pejorative, appeasement. But then appeasement was a positive word. They said, listen, if we'll give in to Hitler a little, we'll control him, we'll contain him, it's enough. It's the last territorial demand that he wants in Europe. And they said, well, he's right, he's got 5 million Germans. Why should the Czechs control 5 million Germans? You make a case for anything, especially if you're an academic that lives, you know, in a fantasy world. So they had plenty of fellow travelers in Britain that were pro-Nazi. Certainly pro-appeasement. And now England and France are staring in the face the fact that Czechoslovakia is going to call their guarantees into action. If Germany moves against Czechoslovakia, then they're going to say, well, England and France should move against Germany. England and France were not prepared to go to war. They were not only not prepared to go to war in terms of military strength, they were not prepared to go to war in terms of psychology. The First World War had destroyed the idea of war. One can hardly blame them. The French lost over 4 million men. An entire generation is wiped out. The British lost almost 1 million men killed. And then you have so many millions wounded and so many shell-shocked and mentally shaken emotionally. The First World War was a cataclysm that destroyed everything. So they're not willing to go to war for Czechoslovakia. British said that, you know, not one Scottish infantryman is worth Czech soil. But they didn't want to appear bankrupt as complete people who renege on their word. So therefore, they forced Hitler to have a conference at Munich. And Mussolini also joined the conference. The other dictator, the other fascist dictator in Europe. And for the first time, the Prime Minister of England flew in a plane, Neville Chamberlain, and he came to Munich, and it was really two conferences, but over a period of 2 weeks, they negotiated away Czechoslovakia. And they prevented Czechoslovakia with a fait accompli. And they said, this is the deal that we have. Take it or leave it. If you, in any event, we're not going to fight for you. And what happened was that Czechoslovakia was divided into sections. The Germans are next part of it. And then later, the Germans just forgot the whole thing, and they marched the army in and took over all of Czechoslovakia. There were Jews in Czechoslovakia also. There had been Jews there for centuries on end. Prague was a famous Jewish center. If you go to Prague today, you can still see a 12th century shul, the Altmai Shul. It was built by the same builders that built the Prague Cathedral. As long as they were there, the Jews said, well, build us a building too, made the stonemasons. Great Rabbonim were in Prague. The noted Yehuda, Rabbi Cheska Landau, Rabbi Yonos and Abishitz, a very famous city. Prague, by the way, is one of the most beautiful cities in Europe, probably after Paris. It is the most beautiful city in Europe. Now, in Slovakia, in the other part, there was Bratislava, or under the Austrians it was called Presburg, where the Chassam Sofer had been the Rav, where there was a great yeshiva. Slovakia broke off from the Czechs, just as it broke off in our time. It's two different countries today. And the head of Slovakia was a Roman Catholic priest by the name of Tiso, Monsignor Tiso. who was a collaborationist with the Nazis and who helped send tens of thousands of Jews to their death. There's a book written by Rabbi Weissmandl, who was the head of the part of the Nitri Yeshiva in Slovakia, and who attempted to save Slovakian Jewry, did great things. He wrote a book called Minametzar, from the Depths of Troubles. And in the book, he records the conversation that he had with Tiso. So they were supposed to ship 10,000 Jewish children in the trains the next day, and he got to him at night, and he said, how can you do this? How can you send innocent children to their death? How can you cooperate with them in doing so? And Tiso answered him, there is no such thing as an innocent Jewish child. Which is the Monsignor in him speaking. And these Jews also got caught up, and immediately at the concentration camp at Theresienstadt. Now, Theresienstadt was meant to be a model concentration camp. And the Nazis didn't use it as a killing camp. If you visit it today, they retained the... Today it's a city, an ordinary city with Czech citizens living there. But they retained one barrack the way it was, so you have some sense of what it was to be in a model concentration camp. The International Red Cross visited Theresienstadt and they said, well, there's nothing wrong here. It's perfect. And Theresienstadt, aside from the thousands of people who died there because of, again, quote, natural causes, unquote, was the holding pen for Auschwitz. Theodor Herzl's daughter died there. Freud, it was an interesting place. So Hitler was furious that he so to speak appeasement worked. That they gave him Czechoslovakia and he didn't take it. And he was so furious he said, that's it, no more conferences. We're not going to do anything. The German general staff said to Hitler that the German army wouldn't be ready for war until 1943. Hitler said, we're going to go in 1939. And Hitler had this view of himself that he was the savior of Germany. So he said, I'm already 50 years old, whatever, you know, don't have that many years left. I have to accomplish all of this in my lifetime because nobody will be able to do it without me. You hear a little of that in Israel today too, that you, without me, nothing good can happen. That's what all our politicians tell us, right? I'm the savior. But nobody is the savior. But he believed that he was the savior. Our guys at least don't believe it. They just say it. But they don't believe it. But he believed it. He was absolutely convinced. And therefore he said, I don't have time to waste. We're going to go to war right away. He had said after they took Czechoslovakia that this was his last territorial demand in Europe. And everybody said, you see, appeasement worked. He doesn't want anything more. But that lasted about a month. The President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, who was re-elected in 1936 by a landslide majority, sent a letter to Hitler, and he asked Hitler to guarantee that he would not have aggression, and he listed there like 35 or 40 countries, one of which was Palestine. Hitler made a speech in the Reichstag, a famous speech. It was broadcast around the world live as he spoke, and he read off the 35 or 40 countries. And he came to Palestine, the whole audience, you know, roared in laughter. And he ridiculed the President of the United States. Hitler believed that Franklin Roosevelt was a Jew. He believed that. And that his real name was Rosenfeld. And the fact that Franklin Roosevelt was a mild anti-Semite and came from old-time Dutch aristocracy in upstate New York, none of that, none of the facts in any way influenced Hitler's beliefs. And so therefore he did not take Roosevelt seriously. That was his great mistake. Because we'll see later that Germany declared war on the United States. The United States did not declare war on Germany. When Japan, yesterday was December 7th, 64 years after Pearl Harbor. I remember December 7th. My mother and I came home from Roosevelt Road, and we were sitting at home, and they turned on the radio, and they had the bulletin that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. Remember, I didn't sleep that night. I was a little kid. I didn't sleep that night because I expected the Japanese to bomb Chicago. The truth is the Japanese did try to bomb areas in the United States, but they were pretty much unsuccessful. The distances were too great. Japan and Germany underestimated the United States. They underestimated what the American response would be. And so Hitler, so the next day, Roosevelt spoke to the American Congress, and he said the famous phrase that a date that will live in infamy, and the Congress voted to declare war against Japan, only against Japan. Now, if Hitler would have had any brains, he would have left it that way.
We have an act with Japan, didn't he, that required him to join Japan in any war with the West, didn't
he? No, so he had this alliance, loose alliance with Japan, but he... The next day, Hitler declared war against the United States. When he declared war against the United States, then the United States naturally declared war against him, against Germany, and they all underestimated what America was going to be. You know, America was turning out 40,000 planes a month at the end of the war. It built a Liberty ship every 6 minutes. And, you know, like, they didn't think it was going to happen. But Hitler sorely underestimated it. He also underestimated the Soviet Union, as we will see. Anyway, Hitler's next demand, and all his demands had enough little reasonableness in it to make it able to float. In the Versailles Treaty, when they created Poland, so Poland had no outlet to the Baltic Sea. It was a landlocked country. And Poland wanted to have an outlet to the sea, because it was blocked in the north by Lithuania and blocked on the east by Germany. So they created what they called the Polish Corridor. It was an 18-mile wide strip of land that ran between two parts of Germany. One part was called East Prussia and the other was called Germany. And then you had this 18-mile wide Polish corridor that ran all the way to the city of Danzig. Then it was, the German name was Danzig. Today the Poles call it Gdansk, which was seaport, it's a seaport on the Baltic. And it was Poland's access to the sea. Now Danzig was basically a German city, 70% German. The Poles made the mistake of trying to make it a Polish city, which always is the problem. Like the French in Alsace-Lorraine did not allow German to be taught, even though the population was German. Everybody had to speak French. And here, everybody had to be Polish. Schools were in Polish, all the signs were in Polish, etc., even though the population is German. It's interesting when you think, for instance, in the United States, that many places in the United States there's more Spanish than there is English, and officially more Spanish than there is English. So that's a different attitude. And maybe that accounts for the fact that the Hispanics in the United States have been more easily assimilated and become part of American culture than otherwise would have been. It's a perverse thing. It's an opposite way. Hitler foments that the Germans in Danzig should demand that they should be freed from Polish rule and that they should be reunited with Germany. It's the same story with Czechoslovakia all over again, with the Sudetenland. And again, he has people in the West that say, well, that's a justified demand. I mean, it was stupid to make this corridor anyway. What right did we have to split Germany into two parts? And the Poles can live without a seaport. Now, good old England and France had guaranteed the borders of Poland as well. But having been burned by Hitler over Czechoslovakia, they no longer preached appeasement. And they warned Germany that if he went ahead with Poland, they would go to war with him. Now, Hitler called them paper tigers. He said the democracies don't have the will to sustain a war. They won't be able to take the casualties again. It's all a bluff. And therefore, he almost ignored whatever threats England and France put to him. And he put tremendous pressure on the Polish government. The Polish government was bitterly anti-Semitic. That's why all of these things in the Holocaust could have been, they could not have been perpetrated without the help of the local population. When we discuss the Holocaust, we'll see that the local population began even before the Germans came. Rabbi Chonon Wasserman was slaughtered in Lithuania, in Kovna, by Lithuanians. There were no Germans there yet. So it's interesting. You know, to live in a country for 600, 700, 800 years, and the Jews lived intimately, for instance, with the Lithuanians, but they, especially in small towns. My wife tells me, my wife was born in Lithuania, she came to America when she was a little girl, but one of her earliest memories was that the non-Jewish Lithuanian girl next door is the one that taught her the brachas. Especially the bracha on the rainbow. Because you lived in the town, they knew everything, you know. But none of this mattered when the mania of the killing lust overcame them all, then you know, didn't make any difference. There were exceptions. There always are exceptions. The exceptions are the ones that make everyone else liable. But in the overall Poland, Lithuania, the Ukraine, they were more than willing accomplices to the destruction of their Jewish communities and their Jewish neighbors. So Hitler makes this demand upon Poland. Now Poland has a large army and a very successful army. In 1923, Poland had defeated Russia in a war. Defeated the Red Army. But that proved to be Poland's undoing, is that they felt that they really could beat the Germans. And also, Poland had cavalry with horses, and the Germans had tanks. And no matter how brave you are on a horse, it's not going to be a match for the armored corps. And Hitler's generals, Guderian especially, who was a genius in tank warfare, who developed tank warfare as was fought in the Second World War. He was to the German army what Patton would be to the American army. So they developed this idea of blitzkrieg, of breaking through with armored vehicles at a certain point in the line and encircling the enemy before the enemy could turn around. It was enormously successful. But Poland thought that they would be able to withstand the German army. England and France also thought so. And therefore, that was part of the reason why they renewed their guarantees. Now, there was no way that a British or French army could come across Europe to help Poland. But they figured they would help Poland with supplies, they would help Poland diplomatically, and that Poland would somehow be strong enough to withstand the onslaught of the Germans. Enter a new piece of the equation, the Soviet Union. Stalin hated Poland, and he didn't want Germany to be on the borders of Russia. And Stalin in 1938 purged the Russian army. He killed 70% of the officer corps, destroyed it. And in 1939, Stalin invaded Finland, and the Finns, a very small country, 2.5 million people, fought him to a draw and had to sign an armistice. So Stalin needed time, and therefore he's willing to enter into a pact with Hitler that he figures will give him enough time to build up the Soviet forces, and Hitler is willing to do it because it will guarantee his victory in Poland, and then he figures later he'll turn against Russia anyway. He doesn't have to keep the pact. Okay, so next week we'll continue to talk about this.
I got it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for everything. Thanks a whole lot.